All right, hello. This is Stefan Kinsella again. I'm doing Kinsella on Liberty. I don't know which number it is. We'll figure that out later. But a friend on the internet asked me to do a discussion about some topics, and so we decided to do it. And Bruno, why don't you introduce yourself and explain what topics you wanted to cover today?
My name is Bruno. Thanks, Stefan, for this meeting here. I wasn't expecting to be part of your podcast. My name is Bruno Pires. I'm just like a physical trainer. I don't have any backgrounds in law or economics, but I came to get interested in Austrian economics. And of course, I got to know about Kinsella's work and everybody in the Mises Institute. Chatting with Stefan Kinsella on Facebook, we decided to maybe try to have a conversation about many topics, mainly about, I don't know, argumentation ethics, about a little bit about his book, and maybe something about money as well later. For
And Bruno,
example,
where do you live?
I'm from Brazil. I live in South Brazil.
You're from New Zealand?
No, Brazil.
You're from
Sorry.
Brazil and you live in Brazil.
South Brazil. That's what I
South
said.
Brazil. Are you affiliated with like the Mises groups there, like in São Paulo or anything like that? Mises Brazil or anything?
Not really. Like, I know those guys exist, but I don't know. Like, to me, like, this is something I was thinking about. Maybe we were not yet to talk about this, but how I became interested with this. I was in Australia in 2013 and trying to follow the political things that were going on in Brazil and United States as well, a little bit in Europe. And so 2013 was a critical year in Brazil, a lot of riots going on, and United States was kind of crazy as well. Like, I think Trump was starting to show some political interest there then. And I was following this on YouTube, and then YouTube suggested me a video which had the thumbnail of the White House, but it was like really dark and some lightning, like a stormy day, I mean night. And it was the audiobook for Anatomy of the State book. So I was intrigued by that thumbnail. I clicked on it and started listening to it, and it was the book Anatomy of the State. So I listened to that, and later I found out about the Mises Institute, and I found out that there was a Mises Institute in Brazil as well. But ironically, as far as I know, the Mises Institute in Brazil, the same thing that happened between the Mises Institute and the Cato Institute happened here as well. So the Mises Institute in Brazil is more like the Cato Institute instead of the Mises
Oh,
Institute.
that's right. You have the Rothbard Institute and the Mises Institute there, right?
Yeah, I think we have more than two. Like, I think
Yeah.
there's like the Hoppe Institute
But I
as
mean,
well.
there was a split, wasn't there? Like there was Mises Brazil and with Helio
Yeah.
Beltrão, and then the Chiocca brothers
Yeah.
formed the Rothbard Institute or something like that.
Yeah, like pretty much
I remember all that. Yeah.
the same thing that happened over there. Like, Cato wanted to be influencing political things, and Rothbard wanted to keep the intellectual stuff, so they broke up. And the rich guys took the Cato Institute
Yeah.
the Hayekian way, I think.
Yeah.
And here and Rothbard kept the Mises line. Here's the same thing. Like, what is called the Mises Institute here is actually like more like Cato than Mises. And these other guys, the Rothbard Institute and the Hoppe Institute, I don't check them too much, but they're trying to not be so Cato Institute like the Mises Brazil is.
Well, you would know more than me, but I mean, I was invited to Brazil, from Mises, Brazil, and met Helio years ago, and
Yeah.
it was great. And you know, because they're named Mises, I would think that they're probably a less Hayekian than the Cato groups are, but I don't know.
Yeah, like to be honest, I don't super follow these guys. Like I check one thing or two here and there. I try to focus more on what you guys do over there, because I think over here they most translate stuff that you do over there.
There's a lot. And I was going to say that I think Mises Brazil translated a lot of the Rothbardian stuff from over here, so they can't be that Hayekian, but and the Rothbard Institute has as well. So if I'm not mistaken, but yeah, I know a lot of the work, and I think my impression has been for years that Brazil may be the biggest hub of libertarianism in the world, maybe next to the U.S. But there's so much libertarian activity, it seems like they're an Austrian economic interest. I can't think of any other country that has more, except maybe the US.
Yeah, like, but here I think, for example, a lot of libertarians or ANCAPs who earlier said that, oh, I would never get involved with politics.
Right.
If I ever run for office, shoot me in the head.
Yeah,
You
yeah,
can
yeah.
find videos of these guys talking things like this, and now they're all running for office. So.
Right. It's
So there's one guy that if you allow me, I would like to make it like an honorary mention is Foer. Maybe you spoke to him on Twitter
sounds
sometimes.
familiar. How do you spell it?
It's FHOER.
Oh yeah, that sound that's yeah.
Yeah. So
That's
like
familiar.
this guy, in my opinion, is the most like kept the roots, you know, the more, how can I say that? Like, he's more in line with the Mises, Rothbard, and Hoppian
Yeah.
line, you know.
Well, apparently those guys can win office. Look at Milei.
Oh, yeah. Are you following that? Like, what do you think about?
I'm trying to, you know, in Turkey, I go to Turkey every year in September for the annual Property and
Yeah.
Freedom Society conference, and there are two talks scheduled to talk about Milei, and like it's going to be like an evaluation of how well he's done. So I think it's a good time because this is September and he got elected what this December last year. So we'll
Yeah.
have about, you know, 9 or 10 months of his track record to take a look at and see whether he's a big disappointment or whether he got anything good done. So in September, I think we're just waiting. Let's give him a little time, but in September we'll kind of have an evaluation and see what we think.
And who's gonna do the stock, you or someone
No,
else?
not me. There's I'll tell you, it's on the PFS website. It's propertyandfreedom.org for anyone interested for the list of the speeches we have planned for the, and we put all these, it's a private meeting, but we record them and put them all online.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Okay, Anthony Muller from Germany and Brazil. So I assume he's a German who lives in Brazil. Anthony
Or
Muller. And it's going to be called Milei After 9 Months of Critical Appraisal. And
All
the
right.
other one is, oh, it's David Durr from Switzerland. He's going to say, if I woke up and found myself president-elect of Argentina, .. like, what would I do? I don't think it's going to really be about Milei. It's going to be about realistically, what could you do, even as a pure anarcho-capitalist, which I'm not sure Milei really is. But even if you were, and you're the head of the state of a modern democratic state, what could you really do practically, without being sabotaged by the system? So but there will be two talks about that. But Mueller's, I'm really curious to see what he says. But yeah, so we're all watching it from afar, and we're interested in it. I was just watching a video on YouTube or Twitter where Milei was asked. Oh, I think he was asked by Ben Shapiro, who are your favorite like thinkers or economists? And he listed Rothbard and Walter Block and Hoppe and Ayn Rand and Robert Nozick and Mises and Hayek. So, you know, it's not bad so far, but that's just talk. We can all talk.
Yeah, like I remember seeing something. The professor Jesus Huerta de Soto was there with him on the inauguration or something.
Oh,
Like
really? I didn't know that. No, I did not know that.
there's a picture of them somewhere, but I don't know if Jesus Huerta de Soto went to Argentina or if Milei was in Europe somewhere and then they meet.
Yeah, I
I'm
mean,
not
he's been
sure.
traveling a lot. He went to the what World Economic Forum in Davos, and he's met with Elon Musk. So I don't know where he is, but he's there are photo ops and he's meeting with people. I do know that some libertarians who are sort of anti-war and anti against the you know, what Israel's doing in Gaza were disappointed already with his pro-Israel statements. Like he didn't need to do that. There's some things he's being blamed for, which I don't know or his fault. Like some people said, oh, I don't know if they do Bitcoin or whatever, but there was some policy of the Argentinian government the other day, and it was definitely a bad
I
one.
know. I know what
But
it is.
what was it? Do you remember what it was?
So like he pretty much like lifted like anything can be used as currency, something like this.
Well, he did
So
what? He did what? He lifted what?
yeah, like for example, like peso is not
Legal tender?
the only legal tender. Like you can trade
Okay.
with anything, like anything can be accepted, something like that. And then the bankers started rioting because they didn't like it, because it took a little bit of power from them. At least I heard something like that.
All I remember is there was some complaint by libertarians saying Milei's screwing this up too, but I wasn't clear that it was Milei's fault. I mean, he's not a dictator.
No, I'm not saying he's a dictator. Like I'm saying that he pretty much lifted any like for example, you could trade with anything,
And he
like
removed that?
any,
So he made
like
it more difficult to trade in Bitcoin, or he made
no, for the opposite. Okay, I know what you're talking about. So
There's
before,
something different. It was some control that we didn't like, and I every they were saying
no.
Milei's failing already, and I said, well, first of all, you don't know if he did this because he's not a dictator, so he can't stop the government from doing certain things because he doesn't have absolute power. So this it may be premature to blame him for this.
No, I
That was
remember.
our fault.
I remember now. So I think right now he made kind of, I don't know if he did it either, but for some reason now the centralized exchanges there have to report to the government and they didn't
Yeah,
like that. It was something
something
like
like
this.
that.
But before that, the reason why bankers were rioting was because he kind of let everyone trade with anything, you know, like a competition in money, like whatever the market decide is going to be it's not going to be the peso necessarily. Okay, like the peso is still legal tender and all this, but you can use whatever you want. And then the bankers didn't like it and they rioted and everything.
Well,
So
anyway,
it's like the timeline is different.
why don't we get to a few topics you wanted to discuss, and let's just go from there. Wherever you want to go, let's take it from whatever you're interested in.
Yeah, like we started talking about this because I found out about a guy who is kind of young, right? Younger than us for sure. And he was talking about like logic. So he was teaching logic fundamentals on Instagram, and he has a bit of a following, I'm sorry, like over 30K followers on Instagram. So he was teaching like logical fallacies, stuff like that. And then I sent him some HOPA stuff, like argumentation ethics, argumentation ethics. And he had never heard of any of this, and he loved it. Like, he told me that he listened to the Property and Freedom Society lecture on argumentation ethics by HOPA like 3 times in a week. He downloaded it to his phone and he was obsessed with it. So he really liked it. He even made a video on which he cites HOPA and talks about, so Karl Popper didn't admit that philosophy had a starting point, but by saying that, he was contradicting by arguing and using a common language and all this.
Yeah, and of course, Mises himself made that point a long time ago, that he explicitly, I think in Epistemological Problems of Economics, that that the assumption behind the method, behind the idea of logical positivism, is itself contradictory, because if you say that only this type of statement is meaningful, that's empirically verifiable. Well, what about that statement itself? Because that's not empirically verifiable. And if it is, it would still be like a circular or infinite regress or a tautology or something. So there's an a priori aspect at the foundations of all the sciences, which even Hoppe points out, and some of the German philosophers point out, is true even for physics. They call this protophysics. So they do give so the Austrians and the Kantians, the realistic Kantians, I should say, not the idealistic ones, but the realistic ones, usually Europeans, they respect the role and the realm of the natural sciences. I mean, the scientific method has a role, but it's not the only thing, number one. And it's also, in a sense, secondary, because it's based upon a priori assumptions. It has to be, just like logical positivism itself is, except the problem is logical positivism is then contradictory. So, but the, you know, physics is not contradictory, but it does rely upon some a priori postulates about how we understand, you know, the three dimensions and space and time and what action is and what knowledge is and things like this. I mean, they're the basic orientation we have to do these investigations. And you could never investigate the basis of the method that you're investigating. It makes no sense. So that stuff's fascinating. And that's in protophysics, which Hoppe writes about a little bit in his Economic Science and the Austrian Method. If your friend is interested in the argumentation, well, he should look at the protophysics stuff, which I mentioned. There's some links in my book. And the book we're talking about is my recent book, Legal Foundations of a Free Society. But, you know, I discuss in pretty a lot of detail Hoppe's argumentation ethics in chapter 6, and also in other chapters, like the one defending, let me see, chapter 22 of the book. So anyone interested in that? And in those chapters, I give a good overview, but I also have links to little mini articles I wrote on my site, where I have lists of like all the key contributions of Hoppe and other commentators on these topics for anyone who wants to get into this deeply.
Yeah, like I remember reading something Hoppe wrote about, for example, for anything empirical, you need a measurement instrument.
Yes.
But before you can even have measurement instrument, you need to establish like a cause and consequence relationship between the means to even get to the measurement instrument, and then you can make your observations.
So, yes, you have to presuppose causality and causation.
Yeah.
But presupposing it And it's self-contradictory to deny this, but that's an a priori type of proof. It's not an empirical proof. And it's at the basis of all this physics, the whole physics superstructure. No, the way I got into it, I was just in law school in 1988, and I just read, there was a Liberty Magazine article, and Hans Hoppe was new to the libertarian world at this time. He had just moved out of grad school to the United States to study with and under Rothbard, which he did for 10 years until Rothbard died in 95. But he published this. That's the first I'd ever heard his name. So there was this symposium in Liberty Magazine, which at the time was sort of like Reason Magazine, but it was a little bit more intellectual and philosophical. And I was blown away by it. I just found it fascinating. And quickly, for the listeners who are not familiar with it, in libertarianism and in political philosophy, there are many different understandings of what rights are, like which kinds of rights we have and what they actually are in principle. So, like, what is a right? And then what rights do we have? Those are two different questions. So legal philosophers might have disputes about what rights are. Are they claims? Are they entitlements, or different formulations? And then what rights do we have? Are there negative rights? Are there positive rights? Are there welfare rights? There are different types of rights. And then how do you justify and figure out which rights we have? And then you have natural law, utilitarianism, etc. So Hans, and like Rothbard and a lot of the early Austrians, and like Ayn Rand, were more Aristotelian or more kind of natural rights based. Like thinking the natural nature of human beings and society and the way the world is has certain normative or ethical implications, which once you understand what human nature is and what the nature of human society is and the nature of the world, you can then say, you can conclude or deduce what's right and wrong and what rights we have. Like that's the kind of natural law approach. And that was sort of Rothbard's approach too, roughly, borrowing from the tradition of Locke and Rand and Aristotle, that kind of stuff, right? But also with a smattering of economic insight, which has a slightly consequentialist or utilitarian aspect to it. So all these kind of things combined. But then Hoppe came along as sort of a realistic Kantian, influenced by Mises, but also influenced by Rothbard's radical libertarianism and radical understanding of politics and individualism. And his argument was, and also influenced by his PhD advisor, Jürgen Habermas, who's a famous, like, democratic socialist, but extremely smart and influential European philosopher, who came up with this theory called discourse ethics, also propounded by another German named Karl Otto Appel. And so Hoppe, when he started learning about Mises and Austrian economics and Rothbardianism after grad school, after Habermas, he remembered the stuff from Habermas about argumentation ethics or discourse ethics, and he had this epiphany that, oh, I can use the insights that Habermas had, which Habermas took them in a sort of democratic socialist direction, but the core insight was that we can figure out or justify the basis of political norms, which is laws and rights, like which laws are good or bad, which laws are justified or not, by realizing that the only way to figure this out is by argumentative discourse between people trying to figure this out. And that always has to happen in a real world context where physical human beings are using scarce resources in the world, or meeting together and having a peaceful conversation about it. And during that peaceful conversation, again, it's peaceful because if it's not peaceful, it's not a real argument. You're just coercing the other guy. So people are willing to listen to each other and to follow the dictates of reason instead of coercion and forcing the other guy to accept their conclusion. So the simple insight there is that there are some normative presuppositions of all discourse, of all discourse that's about which norms are justified. Every time you do that, it's always in that context, which means that you could never propose a norm. You could never justify a norm that you would propose in the argument that has that's contrary to the presuppositions you have as part of the discourse. In other words, you can't have a peaceful argument with someone and say that I'm going to propose the rule that we should kill each other. It's like, well, but the purpose of, we're both agreeing that peace is a good thing because we're having to adopt peace just to talk. So if you really wanted to kill me, just pull your gun out and kill me. But if you want to talk, you're adopting this peaceful framework. And that peaceful framework is sort of like a filter that filters out certain propositions you could ever possibly justify. And so using Austrian economic insights and analysis and the nature knowledge about the nature of scarcity and the way politics works, Hoppe simply says, well, if you know a little bit about economics and you recognize that there are these core basic normative presuppositions of discourse, then every ethic that someone would propose that's a socialist ethic is going to be self-contradictory. So it's a filtering process. He simply says the only norm that could survive, the only political norm that could survive the test is basically the libertarian one, because that one is the only one that's compatible with the peaceful and pro-property rights presuppositions. And so the people who disagree with this, I think they don't realize this, but their core disagreement has to be that they disagree with the idea that there are normative presuppositions of discourse. Now, and again, I think that's enough detail, but the point is, let them try it. Let them try to have an argument with someone, like go to someone's house and say, oh, I enjoy your house, and in a couple of minutes, I'm going to light a fire and burn it down because I don't respect property rights and I'm going to treat it as my own. Okay, at that point in time, you're no longer friendly neighbors. Now he's an enemy and you have to treat him like just a technical problem or a danger to be dealt with, but you're outside the realm of argument at that point. But so long as he says, okay, I'm in your house, it's your house, I'm not going to hit you, I want to persuade you of socialism or whatever, when he does that stance, he's respecting your property rights. And so you can say, well, you're inherently respecting my property rights by having a civilized discussion with me. But at the same time, you're saying it's okay for the government to tax me, to take it and steal it from me. So you got to choose one or the other. And so that's sort of the way argumentation ethics goes. And then, and I think it's a brilliant insight. It blew my mind too. So I can see why your friend was stunned by it. And luckily for him, I mean, when I read it, that was the only thing. There was Hoppe first thing, and then 15 libertarians all disagreeing with him and attacking him, except for Rothbard, basically. But in the meantime, there's a ton of expansion and development and literature on this that anyone interested in this can follow up on.
Can I say just one thing? Like the one example I like to use, two examples when I try to explain this to people. The first one is like, for example, let's say I say there is no right to breathe. But wait a minute, to be able to say that in the first place, you have to breathe.
Right.
Right. So the content of your proposition is incompatible to the prerequisites you Correct. Need to say that in the first place. So
that gets to another nuance of Hoppe's argument, is that what he points out is that using sort of a Kantian framework about the universalizability of norms, which I think Habermas and then Hoppe and Appel also use to some degree. What he points out is that so that kind of context that you just mentioned, you would have one person saying there's no right to breathe, But they don't mean it for themselves because obviously they're breathing to do this. What they mean is, you don't have a right to breathe, but I do. So that's what Hoppe would criticize as a particularizable claim, as opposed to universalizable. And here's what I haven't read any of them put it this way. I've written it. I've written on this way. The way I understand it is, the problem with particularizable ethics as opposed to universalizable ethics. Now, universalizable ethic is the maxim or the rule of conduct that you're inherently or explicitly saying is the right rule, but it has to be a rule, which is not just a concrete instance, but a rule applies to everything that it would cover. But particularizable in a simple form would be something like, you're my slave, and I get to hit you, but you don't get to hit me. And that is the mentality of a criminal or a slave owner or a tyrant. But that's not a persuasive argument because, in a peaceful argumentative context, you could never justify it. Because to justify something, you have to, number one, not contradict the presuppositions of the discourse, which is peace and property rights, core property rights. And you also have to come up with an argument that is based in the objective nature of reality that you can appeal to. So, for example, if you want to say, I can treat you differently than me, you have to have a reason. If you just say, I can treat you differently than me because I'm me and you're you, that's literally not giving a reason. So it's just the same as the war of all against all or a dog-eat-dog society. It's just not an argument. You have to have an argument. So you have to appeal to common reason and to intersubjectively verifiable or objective facts, right? And so, for example, and this is one rebuttal to one of the criticisms against argumentation ethics. Some people will say, well, Hoppe says that you can't deny the ownership of the other person during an argument, and yet it's possible for a slave owner to sit down with his slave for an hour and have a discussion, right? Yeah, but the point is he can't come up with an argument to justify his enslavement of the guy. But then people say, well, you believe in jailing people for real crimes. But the thing is there is that in those cases, you could come up with, there is a difference. So for two equally situated people, if I'm claiming ownership of myself, it's got to be for some reason. And it's because I'm, let's say, it's because I'm a human actor. Well, I can't deny that you're also a human actor because I'm having a conversation with a similarly situated human. So I'm implicitly appealing to my nature as a rational human actor as the basis for the rights that I claim for myself. I can't deny that you have them too because we're similarly situated. I would have to find a difference. And so back in the days of racism, you say, well, it's because I'm white and you're black. But that's not a relevant difference. Like there's no, rights don't come from color. They come from, say, your rational faculty as an actor or as a moral agent or as, I don't know, a child of God or something, whatever. But you would have to have an objective argument distinguishing the people. And of course, in most situations of aggression or domination, you can't do that. So if you claim rights for yourself and you deny them to the other person who's very similar, then it's just contradictory because it makes no sense. It's not an argument, it's particularizable. However, let's suppose a guy murders my family and I catch him and I put him in a cage until the authorities get there, or until I decide to kill him, or whatever. There is an asymmetrical relationship now. I am literally coercing this criminal, this prisoner of mine. And I could have a discussion with him for an hour, and he could try to persuade me to release him. But on what grounds? He could say, hey, Kinsella, it's contradictory for you to say you're a self-owner, but I'm not. And I'll say, no, but here's the difference with the first situation. You committed aggression and I did not. So there is a difference. But in a normal situation where there's no aggression, there's no relevant difference between the people. You can find differences. You can say, I'm white and you're black. But then you have to have a reason why that's a relevant difference. And unless your argument that is that rights flow from color or from race, which, by the way, some people implicitly make that mistake, partly to a degree when they argue for when they argue against abortion, for example, they'll say that, well, if you believe in human rights, then you have to be opposed to abortion because the fetus is a human, right? So what they're implicitly assuming is that because we make the linguistic convenience of calling rights human rights, that rights come from humanness, from being human, which biologically means having certain genes, right? Hold on a second, let me close my door.
Yeah, I should do that too.
Hold on. Cleaning lady just came. I need to. But the thing is, that's just rights don't come from being human. They come from certain other characteristics, like being rational, and humans happen to have that capacity. But only, I mean, most people would recognize that if a space alien race from another star system showed up tomorrow, and they were rational and could communicate with us, they would have rights. So humanness is not the basis of rights. It's something, some other capacity that humans happen to have. And most people think it's rationality, or some people think it's a soul from God. But the point is, it's not your skin color, right? And if you think it is, then you're setting up a war between two races, and then they're not going to have rational communication. They're going to have war against each other and domination. But anyway, that's just some ways to look at some of this.
It cannot be subjective, right? And color today is more subjective than ever, right? You can't identify as a color, so it's super subjective. I mean,
you
cannot, but they think they can, right? That's right.
Well, not only that, it's not relevant. I mean, I have a white dog, a white poodle.
Yeah.
I mean, he has rights, and I have the black poodle that I have doesn't have. No one thinks rights come from color or even from race in the human interracial sense. It comes from the capacities that humans have that most animals, that all other animals, as far as we know, do not have. So it's rationality or something about consciousness, rationality, again, or even a soul. I don't believe in that stuff. But again, that would be a distinction that would be the core for rights. But it's all I'm saying is that during an argument, to have an argument that succeeds in justifying a certain claim, you have to appeal to certain objective facts in the world that are not, and that are also relevant. It has to be relevant. So yeah, again, if it's not relevant, then you're actually not making an argument. It's basically a particularizable claim. You're saying, I get to rape you because I'm me and you're you. How would the victim accept that rule? Like, it's not even an argument. And that's essentially what socialism is. I get to hit you, but you don't get to hit me. That's what statism is, right? Most people agree that we can't commit torts and crimes and theft and rape and robbery and murder of each other, but the state can do it. So they make an exception for the state. It's again, that's particularizable. It's like, I can do it, but you can't.
Yeah.
And that kind of rule could never be accepted as fair by a community because it's not fair and it's not appealing to objective facts. And likewise, as Hoppe points out, this is why property rules arise as they do. To homestead or appropriate unowned resources in the world, you got to do something physical and real with it that establishes a visible public link between you and the thing. Like, you transform it by mixing your labor with it, put a fence around it or embroider it. You do something where everyone can see. And we would call that an objective link. And then the Kantians might call that an intersubjectively ascertainable link. But the point is, it's something real and tangible and establishes a connection that everyone can see. If, on the other hand, you propose a system that where property rights can come from mere, as Hoppe calls it, mere verbal decree, well, The whole purpose of property rights is to solve the problem of conflict over these scarce resources. And the Lockean idea of original appropriation does that, because the first guy who gets it, there's no conflict because no one actually had the resource before. So there's no one there who can complain. Anyone who can complain is pretending to be an owner, but they weren't the first one to use it. So they're not an owner. So the first owner using it doesn't cause conflict. But if he doesn't get to keep it, there would be conflict. That's why once you first possess an unowned resource, you're not causing conflict. And also no one can take it from you. Like those two core rules, like first owner can use it and then no one can take it from him. That's the core of all libertarianism, right? Those rules satisfy the desire to come up with a system where we can all live together in peace and harmony and cooperation without conflict. But if you proposed a property rule where some people can own things by mere verbal decree, by just claiming it, that would generate conflict, because a million people at once could claim to own the moon or North America or Canada or Antarctica or this island or whatever, even though they haven't touched it or been there or worked it or put a boundary around it. So those types of rules are implicit in a lot of the socialist policies that we have now, where the government, the state prevents people from, accessing the Rocky Mountains in America or Virgin Territory or parts of Alaska or whatever. They're acting as an owner, even though they're a criminal organization who has the right to own nothing, and they never did anything to use or transform the land. It's just by mere verbal decree. And of course, this is how wars get started. You could have multiple nations all claiming, no, we have a claim on this North American virgin continent, because one of our explorers set his foot on Plymouth Rock. So we're claiming the entire continent or something like that. You can't claim things that you haven't actually appropriated.
Yeah, like that makes me remember that Misesian insights about the division of labor, that the reason why people cooperate is because they recognize that thanks to the division of labor and the more prosperity that comes out of this, everyone's life is better off. But I can still like, wait a minute, I think I did something wrong here. One sec. Okay, you're back. So like, remember that Misesian insight, like division of labor is the reason, and the prosperity that comes out of this is the reason why people cooperate, right? But yes, there's no ethical component there. It's like an utilitarian argument. Right.
Yeah, I think Mises was more of a consequentialist. I have a blog post I mentioned it in my book. If you just go to my book and search for the word empathy.
But the thing is, like, for example, I remember reading in many places that there is like a normative way to solve conflict, and if it's impossible, if the person becomes like an irrational person, there is the technical way to solve conflict, which is like fighting.
Right.
Right.
Right. Well, so there's a couple issues here. So I think you may be thinking of what I've written about before, expounding on what Hoppe wrote. So Hoppe pointed out that in his argumentation ethics and related ideas, just because you can explain to someone the only justified norms doesn't mean they're going to listen to them, because moral laws or political laws or legal laws, they're not like causal laws or physical laws that are self-enforcing. Like, it's impossible to violate the law of gravity. That's one type of law. But a moral law says you shouldn't do this, but you can still violate it because it's a should, it's a norm, right? And the same thing with even legal laws and with the things politics and governments and legal systems try to corral. What he pointed out was, listen, just because we can have a good argument for why we're all better off according to our own values that we inherently share because of our nature, because of our history, because of our race, because of our social nature, because of what we naturally presuppose when we get together in civilized discourse and argument, doesn't mean that everyone's going to follow it. And for those people, they're outside the reach of reason, and you have to treat them as a technical problem. I mean, you know, if you live somewhere and there's a raging lion or elephant or gorilla, you cannot solve the conflict with him with reason. You got to treat it as a technical problem, and you've got to protect yourself with some means other than reason. Same thing with a hurricane or a disease or a famine. Those are technical problems that humans deal with. And so the simplistic way I look at it is Hoppe and others in Rothbard, they use some simplified scenarios called Robinson Aids or the Robinson Crusoe economics. And they just imagine Crusoe alone on his island, and he faces the same problems any human faces: scarcity, having to act, and various economic implications of that action. It's a simplified economy in a sense. Now, if other humans are on the scene, which is almost always the case, as Mises pointed out, we benefit from living with other people because, number one, we enjoy not being alone because we're a social species. We just enjoy that. It's part of our nature. But we also benefit from it because there's a division and specialization of labor. So we can trade. So there's more wealth. But now this comes with a problem. And the problem is that Crusoe on his island can use scarce means to achieve his ends. And although he can't trade with other people and he's going to live a very simple life, there's no other human around who might take his stuff, right? And if there's animals that might take it, he can deal with them in technical ways, like put up a fence or use a gun or something like that, right? But when there's other humans, you want to trade with them, you want to live among them, but you also would prefer them not take your stuff. Everyone's better off. And most people know this, the people that are not sociopaths. And so, again, there's two ways to deal with other people taking your stuff. One would be treat them as a technical means and treat them like an animal. But because we have reason and empathy with each other because of our social nature, which is where I think Mises's point gets to a normative point. Because we have empathy, we know that most of our fellow men who are not sociopaths have shared core values. So you can appeal to those shared values combined with reason to persuade them to go along with a societal system of property norms. And that actually seems to work, right? We've seen that happen for thousands of years. Not perfectly, but more or less. So that's where the norms come in from this empathy realization and from the reasoning aspect of man, when we can use our reason to realize the benefits of trade. And because we prefer it, because most people are not sociopaths.
Yeah, I remember like reading your book at some point. It says that today might makes a right, right? But that's unjustifiable. Like that's pretty much where I was going to get when I brought up the Mises insight about division of labor and people cooperating, right? Because like even if I understand that thanks to division of labor, we can have a higher standard of living. And so that's why I'm not gonna punch you on the face or something. Even if I decide to punch you on the face, I cannot justify this. And that brings me to an interesting question. That is, for example, we now have like the blockchain, right? And the blockchain is a technology that made other things obsolete, in my opinion, banks, for instance. But not only banks, registries as well. But as we live in a era where might makes right, I can't like put some document on the blockchain and say, here is cryptographically verified, authenticated, And I don't need like a registry to say that this document is valid. So there's going to, the same way the banks are going to fight to keep the, to try to have like a some relevance still, even though they are already obsolete thanks to the blockchain, registries can, it can be considered obsolete as well, because you can verify and authenticate documents thanks to the blockchain. And here in Brazil, there are registries that are using the blockchain. So they are just acting as a middleman to take money from people and present this, themselves as this traditional authority, the might that in whatever they say. For example, you can put something on the blockchain, like a, some document or something, and it's there, it's valid, it's authenticated, everything, right? But then the registry, oh, but we don't recognize that. And we have the monopoly on violence. So I think that's going to be an interesting fight and discussion moving on.
Okay, well, a couple things. Anyone who says might makes right doesn't understand the difference between fact and value, is and ought. They don't understand what the difference between possession and ownership, factual control, and the legal right to control. They're just different things. If you think might makes right, you're basically a type of monist who doesn't believe in rights at all. Like, if might makes right, there are no rights. So that's a total confusion. As for registry, do you mean like title registries for property? What do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not a huge expert on this, but I am, my current opinion, and I'm willing to be proven wrong on this, I think Bitcoin is, but, or some cryptocurrency. I don't know if it'll be Bitcoin. I think it may be, but a digital money will be useful if it's decentralized and inflation proof and censorship proof. Okay. That will be useful. And I think it's inevitable. I don't know how long it'll take. It's inevitable, unless we have World War III next month, which may happen. I see that's the only function. It's just to be a better money than the fiat money that the government has come up with to screw up the original fairly good commodity money we used to have. So money's a useful thing in society. Fiat money ruins that part of money because it can be censored and inflated. So a digital money that solves that problem is good. I don't really see the function of such a technology as having anything to do with data storage, registries, proof, etc. Who knows? Maybe. I don't know. I don't.
Well, for
I don't,
example,
go ahead.
For example, here in Brazil, there is a Bitcoin enthusiast who wrote a book back in 2013. Fernando Urich is his name. I don't know if he's going to listen to this. He lives right here in my city. And when his daughter was born, that's way back. I think there was only Bitcoin and Ethereum, maybe. I don't even know. And he was never... He was like a, he's still a Bitcoin maximalist to this day. And he said he put his daughter's birth certificate on the Bitcoin blockchain way back.
Yeah.
So it's possible, right?
It's possible. I just don't see what problem it solves. So because, you know, he could have had a blog, he got out a blog, a WordPress blog for free, or a Blogger blog or something. And he could have just posted an image of that too. Or he could digitize it and put it on his hard drive at home. Or I'm sure there's a government registry that keeps these things. So I don't, I mean, money solves the problem of barter. Okay. With, in a barter society, you can't calculate and you have a trade problem, right? You can't have, because of the double coincidence of wants problem. So money solves that problem. Then the government comes along and screws up the money by centralizing it and by inflating it. And so money still forms part of this function of exchange and calculation, Although the calculation function is degraded when there's always inflation, but it still works as exchange a calculation better than a barter society would. But the government has basically ruined money. So the whole purpose of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency is to get back to a money that actually works and solves the original problem money was supposed to work. So a workable cryptocurrency solves a real problem. I don't think that we have a problem in the world of being able to know who owns which piece of property or when people were born, that a cryptocurrency blockchain would solve. It's just not solving a real problem that exists. I think it's more like a geek activist thing. You know, like in the beginning, I'm more of a maxi in the sense of I do think that it, for now, it's going to have to be increasing in store as a store of value kind of thing to avoid inflation. So it's solving the problem that you don't want to store your money in dollars. You can use it for everyday exchanges, but you don't want to, if you're worth $1 million, you don't want to have $1 million of your wealth in cash because you're going to lose 5% every year or whatever it is, you know. So you would keep it in stocks or real estate or paintings or maybe gold or maybe Bitcoin. You keep it in something that doesn't get inflated. So it's solving that problem right now. And then later on, because it's homogeneous and a hopefully fungible, it will be, it can be used as a currency as well when we get to that point. That's sort of how I think about it. But there's no big problem in society of people not being able to know who owns the house down the street. The system works fine. I mean, the government runs it. It's a county records office maybe, but
Yeah, but like instead of, for example, the same way the blockchain broke the bank monopoly on money transfer, right? The blockchain can also break the monopoly on, like, for example, for example, if I wanna, I go to the title registry down the road and they have like, oh, here you have the stamp, blah, blah, blah. But I don't need this guy to see it and stamp it. I can have the miners to do that, for example.
I think that's more
And then
complex.
it's and it's
Yeah,
this and it is
I know what you're thinking.
decentralized.
I know what you're thinking. But the thing is, you do need to go to the title office because the legal system, we don't have anarchy. We still have a state.
Yeah, I mean, but going this direction, you know, like it's
Yeah,
not
but yeah,
like this
but
right
but
now. We still have
even
banks.
yeah, but even if you imagine anarchy, they might be fine with just a local physical title office as a private title office. I mean, I don't see what advantage you get from putting it on the blockchain. But, and not only that, I actually think that it's possible that different block, I mean, a lot of these blockchains are using like Ethereum. I mean, if you're a Bitcoin maxi, you think eventually there's just going to be one. Like what about all these NFTs? They rely upon their own little stupid blockchains. They're all going to disappear. So then where's the data? Who's maintaining it? Because there's no fine, see, there's only a financial incentive for miners to mine a blockchain that's purpose is to produce money. So that's why I kind of think that the only purpose of a blockchain, which is a horribly inefficient spread ledger system, its only purpose is to be the backbone of a digital money. And you know, if I wanted to store data, there's way better ways to do it than putting it on the monetary blockchain. And so what if Bitcoin in works for 30 years? And then in 30 years, Bitcoin number 7.5 comes out and everyone thinks it's way better and we switch over to it. Where's all the data that was on the first Bitcoin ledger? I mean, do we lose all of our records that were on that? Who's maintaining it? There's no miners left anymore. Bitcoin 1.0 disappeared. So the whole idea of it's not permanent. I mean, there's got to be other ways to store data permanently. I just don't think of Bitcoin
Well,
as a solution to data preservation, because there's nothing wrong with changing monies. I mean, you could change from Bitcoin 1 to Bitcoin 7 in 30 years. What's wrong with that? Society might say, okay, we're going to go to a money that's got some better properties. Doesn't matter what money you have.
yeah, I wouldn't say data preservation, but for example, right now, for hundreds of years, all the data was like on paper, right? But then we got a lot of this data that was on paper and make copies of this, of digital copies of this, right? And maybe in the future something else is going to happen, and then we're going to take it out from digital and turn into this something else. So we're just changing the medium where we are keeping the data. So, but that's not the problem. The thing that I think is it changes, it adds to, is the how are we validating, how are we authenticating this information, right? You know, and of course, not going to be all information. Maybe.
No, I hear you. I hear you. I'm just saying, I would be happy if we can have a good sound money again. That would satisfy me. I'm not trying to add like a Christmas tree with lights, 17 other functions on top of the function of blockchain, like smart contracts and real estate records and birth certificate records. I think it's, I mean, I could be wrong. I'm an old guy. I'm very conservative. I'm very skeptical. I don't believe these things right away when I hear enthusiasts talk about it. Again, there were people in the early days of Bitcoin, they thought it was so neat that they could buy a cup of coffee with a Bitcoin, but it was just a stunt because you can also buy a cup of coffee with a dollar. I mean, it didn't really add anything to your life to be able to do that. They were just trying to prove that it was, isn't it amazing that we can have decentralized, peerless, peer-to-peer exchanges without any permission and do this? Yeah, it's interesting. It's a good party stunt, but what does it do you? And I think that's what people do. They're like, oh, I could put my birth certificate on the blockchain. Isn't that neat? But what really, in today's world, what good does it do? I think it's more of a proof that you could possibly do it in the future, but I don't think it's really necessary or realistic right now. Again, I could be wrong about all this, but I don't pretend to be an expert on it. But you did mention about banks. Let's talk about banks really quickly. You said that banks are not going to be, I don't know, necessary something. So the way I think about it, being an Austrian and being a big critic of fractional reserve banking and, of course, central banking and, of course, fiat currency. I think that the state involvement and their intermixture with the finance and banking industry over the last couple centuries has corrupted everything. And it's muddled and muddied together two separate functions of what we think of as banks. One is storage, just storing people's money like gold originally, but then that became paper tickets, and then the state monopolized it, and then fractional reserve banking started on top of that, and it's not really storing anything, but it became a central clearinghouse. And the second function is credit intermediation, which is basically, I've got some wealth and I want to make some profit off of it. So I could loan it to someone if I can go find someone who wants to borrow money from me and do a promissory note, and I could give them a loan to start their business. But I'm just a regular guy. I don't have time to do that. I don't know who. So I go to a bank, and the bank has other people come to them as borrowers, and the bank loans money to them after doing credit worthiness checks. And the bank loans it out at a certain interest rate, and then they pay me part of that as the depository. So they're credit intermediaries. Frankly, as a Bitcoin kind of nut, I suspect that whole, okay, so let's talk about the storage function. Do you really need a storage function in a Bitcoin world? I see if you have a bunch of gold, you need to put it somewhere. So you might put it in the bank. Plus you need to write checks. But in a Bitcoin world, you can store your own stuff on a little thing, and you don't need to write checks. You can just send money without anyone's permission. So that function of banks might disappear. It might not, because some people like custodians like Coinbase, but that's just for convenience. I don't think they need to do it really. It's just a convenience thing. And they have almost no cost. So they don't have to make up for the cost of the storage fees by loaning some of the money out in a fraudulent way. And which Coinbase doesn't. Coinbase is basically a 100% reserve storage bank. Let's call them storage banks. Now, the second function, credit intermediation, I think that could be a valuable function, but it wouldn't really be a bank. It would just be someone who helps you find, they're like, they get a finder's fee for helping you find a borrower for your money. But I sometimes wonder if in a future Bitcoin world, the practice of loans and lending and debt would almost disappear. I think we're so used to that because we live in a fiat world, an inflationary world, and an impoverished world where everyone takes out, they get in debt and they have to get a mortgage to buy a house. I could imagine in a very rich, very prosperous, sell money world, everyone's mentality changes. And
well,
they're
there's
like,
that,
yeah, go ahead.
There's that thing Hoppe says, like, you cannot anticipate a future good except at a discount, right? So maybe you have some Bitcoin or whatever, but you don't have enough to do whatever you want to do. So you need to borrow it from someone. So
well,
maybe.
what I was envisioning was like say a young guy gets out of high school, he starts working, he's paid in Bitcoins, he's making a really good salary because we live in a free market world now. He just rents an apartment, right? He rents a house or rents an apartment. And he also saves up money, he saves up Bitcoin. So he pays rent for 5 years, and 5 years later, he buys a house for cash because he has $1 million worth of Bitcoins. So why would he ever take a mortgage out? This whole practice of doing mortgages for things is insane. And not only that, you know, if I want to start a business, instead of taking a loan out from other people, why wouldn't I just ask them to invest? Because lots of people are going to have Bitcoins and they're going to not want to keep all of their wealth in Bitcoin. They're going to want to make some returns from equity investments, like in the stock market or maybe in their friend's restaurant or something. Why would you need to do it as a loan? Just let them become a 1/10 owner and they're an equity owner. I mean, I could be totally wrong with this, but I have a suspicion that both functions of banking may disappear in a Bitcoin world. You really won't need them for storage. And if the idea of debt and credit disappears, then credit intermediation will be a thing of the past. But in either case, I just think they should be distinguished, right? And so if you want someone to custody your stuff, use Coinbase or use some little wallet or whatever, or a side chain for some of it, you know, like Lightning Network or Liquid or something. And if you want to do credit intermediation, you would go to a bank. I just think you would have two types of banks, and they should, one's a credit intermediation, I just think they should call them credit intermediaries, you know? And the other one, you can call them a custodian, Bitcoin custodian service. Like, just let's get rid of the word bank. Anyway, that's sort of how I think about this. But this is one topic we brought up that I don't pretend to be a deep expert on.
Yeah, like, what do you think about this, the custody thing? Because I remember, Satoshi said that if a trusted third party is still needed to prevent double spending, the main benefits are lost, something like that.
I think there's something to that. I mean, honestly, I'm not religious, so I don't really care what Satoshi said or thought or what his vision was, to be honest. So it's worth looking at or thinking about. But
yeah, because the purpose was like, get rid of the intermediaries, right? And because you don't need this intermediary to, or like this trust model, as he calls it, to make the payment go through, you can drop the cost tremendously in this, the financial cost of transaction. That's what he says, like right in the introduction. Right. And then if you bring back the intermediary, the cost goes back up and then defeats the purpose of the whole thing in the first place.
Well, my view is that the problem with the intermediary is the problem of centralization, right? And the problem of censorship.
And the cost as well. The cost is higher because you have to pay this guy.
Yeah, but okay. What's revolutionary about money is it solves a big problem. It solves two big problems of barter. So that's why money emerged and was good. Okay. And then the state, through various things in history, has screwed up money and made it inflate all the time, which means it cannot be a store of value and it robs people. And it goes through central channels. So there's censorship is possible. So that's the main problems, right? So the promise of a digital cryptocurrency is to solve those things. And that would be a big advancement. It would be a big problem to solve, just like money solved the big problem of barter. Right? So, but the problem that digital money solves is not that it costs $20 to send a wire to someone, and it's like $2. Like that's a minor improvement, but that's not a fundamental transformation of financial life and human life to have slightly more efficient fees. I don't think that's the promise of a cryptocurrency. Now, it's possible that you can have maybe things like side chains, which have almost zero fees, and that would might enable innovations like micropayments or something like that. Oh, that's funny. Did you see the thumbs up? I did this and it.
I thought we were live in someone.
No, I thought so too, but I think that's a new Zoom feature. I don't know what else you can do. Anyway,
Like for example, like in very poor countries where people don't even have access to bank accounts, stuff like that, they are completely isolated
yes.
economically. So if you really have like a peer-to-peer low fee, like insanely low fee, like you can bring all these people in the economy.
No. I agree, except yeah, I agree with that. I still think that's like an edge case. I think like transfer payments and third world stuff is not, again, it would be great if we can help that situation, but
Let me
that's
just
not.
really quick
Go ahead.
tell you a personal story. Like I work at a cruise ship out of Fort Lauderdale. And we went to the Caribbean and we went to places like there are rich islands and poor islands. And I remember I saw this with my own eyes. I saw like a line, like a bunch of people waiting in line. I was like, what is this? What are these people waiting for? Oh, this is the line for the MoneyGram or Western Union. And these people, there is like a 20% fee for them to send money back to their family in the poor island. So I think like
No, I
cryptos
totally agree
and
with I agree for transfer payments, and I think that's one of the only big use cases in terms of use of Bitcoin today is for transfer payments. I understand that. But on the other hand, it doesn't have to, if you're just like a rich American and you want to send $1,000 of value back to your relative in some third world country, all you got to do is convert your dollars to some crypto. Then there's 20,000 of them, right? I don't even know if it matters which one it is. You just convert it, you send it,
30,000.
huh?
30,000
Sorry,
already.
30,000. You send it, and then they get it, and then they convert it to their local currency. So it's just a convenient mechanism to get around the state. You could use Bitcoin, you could use Bitcoin Cash, you could use Ethereum, I guess. I mean, because it's a temporary, but that's not the fundamental case. The end case for, I think, a cryptocurrency, it needs to be the world's reserve currency. It needs to be something you can store a significant chunk of your wealth in without it being deflated. And by the way, so let's say Bitcoin's fees are not just a penny, but they're higher. They're getting closer to the Western Union fees because the size of the block is small. Network congestion or whatever, however that works. I don't pretend to be an expert on that. I don't see any reason why side chains couldn't emerge. And again, even if they didn't emerge, you can use Litecoin or Bitcoin Cash to do that temporary transfer payment. I just don't think that's the main thing. I think to imagine it ever becoming the dominant world reserve currency where there's no national currencies left anywhere that anyone uses. It's just a one world money standard, like it used to be, sort of with gold, right? It would be just Bitcoin, or some other currency. I don't know. I'm not stuck on Bitcoin, but let's say it's Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a world reserve currency. That's all anyone ever uses, and when they want to make daily transactions with people that are small, like a dollar or 50 cents or $5, they might
Or
use side. They
sub
might use side
things.
chains. They might use side chains. Why not just use a side chain? If there's no reason to, I'm not persuaded that there's any reason to think that in the next 10, 20, 30 years, we're not going to perfect some side chain technology that works with very, very low fees.
Were you persuaded by the book? Because I remember
Which
you.
one? Roger Ver's book?
Yeah.
I'm like two-thirds through it right now. I'm not persuaded by it. It's very well written, I will say. It's very well structured and organized. They did a lot of work carefully collecting details. I think it's a little bit, it's from a perspective that they don't realize that is not the only perspective to have. They have this obsession with Bitcoin being a one blockchain system with no side chains that can be used for
Not
quick, easy.
really, not really. I remember listening to interviews from Roger Ver, and he said in this book, like I listened to the audiobook of this. It was quicker, and he was pro Lightning Network, and you can
No, no,
even.
no, no. He was pro Liquid, I think, but he says that, yeah, he says that you can
No,
build on Bitcoin Cash, which he's advocating.
yeah, like he's
He
not
says
against
you, oh,
that.
he
Yeah.
says you can build side chains, but still they want the base layer to be able to be the cash layer that you can use for cheap transactions. And to enable that, you need 8 gigabyte blocks and this kind of stuff in a few years. I mean, and I find his hand waving at the when he says, oh yeah, that would require 42 terabytes of data for every node runner every year. That's not a big deal. Like, I think 42 terabytes, and it's not just the storage. It's first of all, that's every year and that's cumulative, and it's going to grow exponentially. And there's downloading the block and there's communicate. I'm still persuaded by the small blockers and all this stuff in the book. I think it sounds roughly accurate. He's coloring things a certain way. I still don't see anything nefarious in what the small blockers did. They did what they believed. They have a certain view and they use their position to do it. I don't see that any rights were violated. I don't believe all these conspiracy shit like the CIA was behind that guy, John, I forgot his name. I mean, because he said he works in intelligence, but on his side hobby, he's trying to promote Bitcoin. That doesn't mean the CIA is trying to sabotage Bitcoin or the because one investor in Blockstream, this French guy, he's a member of the Bilderberg group. Oh, so that means this international conspiracies. This is all just insane. I think it's just crazy conspiracy theorizing because they want to tell a narrative that it was sabotaged by the nefarious state powers and the banks. I don't think there's any reason to. I'm a big anti-conspiracy theorist. I don't go in for that kind of
Like,
stuff.
do you agree that the layer one should be enough to support any layers two, right?
I don't know. Maybe get a five layers. I don't know how. I don't know. Maybe
Yeah,
layer one supports layer two. Layer two supports layer three.
but I remember your question on Twitter or X was this, like, oh, I read something on this book that got me a little bit concerned,
Yes.
and
Yeah.
so I don't know if.
Well, I was halfway. I was one fourth through the book. Then he was talking about the problems that he sees with Lightning. Now, I'm sure that Lightning proponents might have a different narrative. I haven't heard it yet, but if he's right, well, maybe Lightning won't work. Maybe something else will work. Maybe Venmo will work. Maybe Venmo Bitcoin will work. Maybe Visa Bitcoin will work. But or maybe something else will work. But and he mentioned offhand something, but he didn't elaborate. Something about, a large block side chain. And I thought he was implying that that proposal is you got Bitcoin as a base layer and then it's connected to a large block side chain and then Lightning connects to that. Because what he was arguing was that Lightning connecting to the Bitcoin layer, there's not enough bandwidth in the block size to accommodate everyone becoming a Lightning Network user. Like there wouldn't be enough time to get them on. I don't know the technical details of this. I think maybe eventually the Bitcoin core people will agree to a consensus hard fork and increase the block size a little bit to make side chains more viable. Or maybe you just go base layer, side chain, second side chain, third. I don't really know, to be honest. I'm not an expert on this kind of stuff.
Do you think that for having one developer group, the core, it's kind of centralized in this aspect?
I don't know. I see the arguments Vera makes. I don't know enough about it. In a sense, because I don't think money is wealth, and I think this is a mistake a lot of people make. Money is not wealth. Money is just an intermediary. I mean, Hoppe and Mises, or at least Rothbard, I don't remember, they call money, it's not a consumer good, it's not a capital good, it's sui generis. It's a good because it's useful, but it's just an intermediate of exchange. And unlike gold, which has a non-monetary use value, a cryptocurrency has zero non-monetary use value. It's purely money, which means that it's just the connection between people exchanging goods of real value, real wealth, which means to me it doesn't matter what the money is. So I don't care if it's Bitcoin or if it's Monero or if it's Litecoin or Bitcoin God or Bitcoin Hoppe or whatever. I don't care what it is. And I don't really care if we use Bitcoin for 20 years and it works fine and then we realize it's too rickety, because it's still better than gold and it's still better than the fiat dollar system. But at a certain point, technology and the usage might get to a point where we need, I don't know, Monero, let's say. And so let's say we switch over. The thing is, I don't care, because I don't think wealth is destroyed when you, if all the gold in the world disappeared, we would lose wealth as a human race, because it has a non-monetary use value, right? And if it was, especially even if it wasn't money, but if Bitcoin just like one day crashed and disappeared, yeah, some human beings would lose their fortune because they stupidly put their money into cash, and they put it into a digital cash that could crash. Now they're doing it now because it's a speculative time, because they think it might be a phase of adoption. I don't think in the future, when a certain cryptocurrency is adopted, I think what would happen is the price goes up and it plateaus at a certain point. Let's say Bitcoin's $70,000 now, you know, let's say it plateaus at $10 million when it's getting close to the representative value of the universal medium of exchange that represents the value of the whole world, basically, something like that, right? At that point, you don't invest in Bitcoin because it's just going to appreciate in purchasing power every year by the roughly the rate of growth of the world's economy. So it's going to be like an index fund for the world. Okay, so you can put your $3 million of net wealth in Bitcoin if you want, but then there's a chance that it might be replaced someday by another money that's better. And then you would lose everything. So I think what my personal view, and all my Bitcoin friends think, don't agree with this. They think the average person should never invest in anything except cash. I said, yeah, but the problem is cash is not wealth, and cash can be, the current type of money that is cash can evolve in human society. And so what I envision is, let's say one scenario, Bitcoin keeps going up in value, and the more it goes up in value, the more waves of adoption you get, the more FOMO you get, all this kind of stuff. And so in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, eventually it becomes the de facto world reserve currency. And it's say 10 million bucks a coin. Of course, it might be more than that if the dollar is hyperinflating. It might be $17 billion a coin, but I'm talking about in terms of current purchasing power. It, like, one Bitcoin might be worth in purchasing power in 30 years what 10 million US dollars can buy you now. That's what I'm saying, right? So in that world, now I'm just a prosperous guy living in a mostly free market because the governments have been denuded of most of their spending power because they don't have fiat banks that anyone buys their bonds anymore. So they have to live on their taxes only, right? So governments are smaller, there's more free markets, everyone's richer. Okay, I got 3 million purchasing power, 2024 dollars worth of bitcoins, which probably is like 0.02 bitcoin, just I don't know what it is, right? So I've got a fraction of a bitcoin of wealth. Would I keep all of my wealth in bitcoin? I don't think I would, because number one, I would want to chase even, I mean, I don't mind getting 6% returns because the world GDP is growing at 6% a year. I don't mind that. That's not bad in terms of purchasing power. But hey, my friend tells me if I buy the stock market index, I can make 8%. So I might put some of my money there. I might buy real estate. Or I might think if money changes to another form, I'm screwed. So I want to put like 80% of my wealth in real things. So that if Bitcoin changes to Bitcoin 7.5, I don't lose everything that I have. So that's how I picture the future of a crypto world. But you see,
Yeah.
none of this has anything to do with banks or with making micropayments or with storing your birth certificate on the thing. I mean, those things, who knows what's going to happen, but the fundamental thing to me is to have an inflation hedge and a censorship resistant system.
This friend of mine, Foyer, this libertarian guy who has a YouTube channel and sometimes talks to you, on Twitter. He has a funny argument, like every Bitcoiner who thinks you should only buy Bitcoin and nothing else. He says like, oh, I'm producing food, so you are basically saving Bitcoin for me when you come to me to buy my food.
That's good. I mean, I don't even say people should buy Bitcoin. I mean, it being a pro Bitcoin guy is like for my libertarian side, okay? Forget about economics even. The reason I like Bitcoin as a libertarian is because, again, it's a way to reduce the state's ability to spend money, and it's to reduce the state's ability to rob the average person and the poor with inflation. And to censor their transactions and to control them. So that to me, that's the promise of a digital money. But because we don't have one yet that's universally adopted and it's really a money yet, if we're ever going to get there's going to be a period of adoption. And that period of adoption is between now and sometime in the future. And that means that some cryptocurrency is going to appreciate in value a lot because anything that becomes money has a monetary premium. And so as an investor or as a speculator, that's the reason to invest something in Bitcoin now. It's not to be an activist or to be part of some project or to spend it or to use it. In fact, if you think the price is going to keep going up because it might be adopted, you'd be stupid to use it, in my view. I mean, using it means spending it or getting rid of it. So I don't see the point.
Well, for example, Hoppe has this amazing paper. I think it's the Austrian and Marxist class struggle or something like that, class
Analysis. Analysis.
analysis. And he's explaining time preference, the difference between the capitalist and the worker. They have different time preferences. So, like, why doesn't the capitalist don't just save all his money? Because he is a consumer too, and cannot help being one, right? Remember when he said that?
No, I agree with that. But the thing is, if I want to be a consumer now, I can just use dollars. Dollars work perfectly fine, and your local fiat currency, I'm sure, works fine.
Sure, but what if
Going to
dollar
a
goes to
merchant is fine.
zero? If
What's that?
dollar goes to zero, you're gonna spend your Bitcoin. Because you're a consumer and cannot help being one.
Well, if the dollar goes to zero, I mean, Bitcoin's already maximized and plateaued, and of course you would spend it then. It would be the universal money. But it wouldn't be going up to 10 million then. It would be already at 10 million. I'm just saying that right now, when it's in the adoption phase, it's going from 70,000 to a million or 5 million or 10 million. Why would you get rid of it now? You don't need to do that. And the dollar's not zero. And the Brazilian, what is it, real? What is it? Oh, it's not zero. I mean, they work. It's just you're stupid to keep your savings in it. That's all. It actually works. It's just But no, I agree. There are some narrow use cases even today with these transfer payments, like you're talking about. So it's useful for that.
Yeah, but for example, even Saifedean, he says that, for example, oh, don't use your dirty dollars because you are financing wars, blah, blah, blah. So,
Really?
yeah.
Well,
Like,
I guess you could make a moral case for it. And there's a guy, a friend of mine named Joel Baumgart. He's a Mississippi businessman, former politician type, who's a big he's on Facebook, I think. And he claims that he uses this Bitcoin credit card, and he claims that he makes money off of it because, he just puts all of his money into his, I don't know, Coinbase account or whatever it is. And everything he buys on his Bitcoin credit card. But because there's a time delay and because the price keeps going up, he might put
Yeah,
20.
but this is like BitPay, right? You think you're paying with crypto, but you give your crypto to BitPay, and BitPay gives its dollar to the vendor, but you're
Yeah,
still using
it's
dollars.
a conversion, but it's stored in Bitcoin until you spend it. And so
Yeah, exactly.
because of the time delay, if the price goes up, then if I put 20,000 in, and then in a year I buy a $10,000 car, but now my Bitcoin might be worth 40,000. So I actually got a car for free, and I have $30,000 of worth left. But of course, sometimes the price goes down, and I don't think it works in those times. But I guess you could. But it's a stunt. I mean, no normal person is going to do this. This is not how we're going to get adoption, I think, by hectoring people to get a Bitcoin credit card. And they're going to go, why? Why?
If we have time for one more question,
Yeah, let's do one more, and then I need to go.
I would like to ask, for example, have you get to this part where Roger Ver on his book argues that medium of exchange precedes the store of value, and he even cites Mises and Rothbard, because like Rothbard has this quote on the what government has done to our money, that oh, people think money has all these other functions like unit of account, of store of value. It's even in quotes, right? But the
I don't think I've gotten there yet. I've seen him mention other people saying, that argument that medium exchange has to come first because it has to have a use case
Yeah, like
and store of value.
Rothbard
But he,
says that
I don't
the moment.
I haven't gotten to the part where he quotes Rothbard and Mises yet, but I'd be curious to get to that part. I'm reading it. I was reading it too this morning,
Yeah,
so
I don't
what's
know.
he say?
Maybe,
What does he say?
well, Rothbard on this book, "What Has Government Done to Our Money," says that. Well, people think money has all these other functions, but there are only corollaries of the one function, medium of exchange.
I've always honestly I've always thought that because I've never in my life until the Bitcoin stuff happened, I never heard of store of value or unit of account. I always only heard of medium exchange, and I understood that. But I do think they're all interrelated. I've always also been skeptical of the interpretations most people give of Mises' regression theorem. Like some Austrians used it in the beginning to say that Bitcoin can never work because it didn't have a commodity use value first. And so therefore Mises proved this. I think they're totally misinterpreting the whole point of Mises' regression theorem. And anyway, I don't think we can really figure out a brand new phenomenon like this we've never seen before with some kind of 1930s reasoning from the analog age. I mean, we have to be a little bit humble and see what happens. I don't think Bitcoin is money yet. It's not a medium of exchange. I think it will be money when it's a medium of exchange.
Well, it is a medium of exchange, but it's not money, because money is the most commonly used medium of exchange,
Well,
right?
I mean, I think of money is not a binary. It's a spectrum, right? There's moneyness, and Bitcoin has a very low degree of moneyness at this point. The dollar has a very high degree of moneyness at this point. It's just that the fiat money, like the dollar, and probably every other fiat currency in the world, is not very close to what you imagine being an ideal money, because governments can inflate it. That's it. And they can inflate it because they have de-anchored it from the original limited supply commodity of gold and silver, that kind of stuff, right? And so I think that I think for anything to become money, it has to, and I have heard other accounts, like from, I don't know, maybe Vijay Boyapati, maybe Saif Amous, I can't remember. They sort of reinterpret the Karl Menger, maybe Mises, origin of money idea about, you know, might not have been an exact historical reconstruction or chronological reconstruction of exactly how money did emerge. You know, there could have been an aspect of when something like gold becomes a money, it did have a value first, just like Bitcoin had a value first as a collectible sort of libertarian thing, you know?
But then you have to remember the subjectivity of value, right? Nothing is a store of value, right?
Correct. I totally agree.
Yeah,
I totally agree. I'm a little bit skeptical of that metaphor, because I'm a subjectivist. But the thing is, let's suppose there's a barter society with no money, and there's something of value like gold or seashells or whatever, and people start maybe on occasion using them as an intermediate, an indirect medium of exchange, and people start recognizing more and more people are doing this, so they start anticipating that this thing might someday become more widely used as a medium of exchange. And then they might recognize that, well, if that happens, it's going to get even more value, like it's going to get a monetary premium, which means these seashells, I can trade 100 seashells for a cow right now, but more and more people are starting to use this because they're finding this medium of exchange thing to be useful. Maybe I'm going to hold on to them because they might be worth 10 times as much in 2 years. And so it's sort of a process like that. And so people start collecting them in anticipation of its future widespread use as a medium of exchange. I think that's what's going on with Bitcoin right now. The reason it has a value of $70,000 is because people think it's going to keep going up in value. Why do they think that? Well, I think they know that its supply is limited, so it can't be inflated. And they also know that it's homogeneous and fungible, so it potentially could be used as a medium of exchange sometime in the future. So they're sort of anticipating this future time when it will start being used as a medium of exchange. But if it's ever used as a medium of exchange, then its value will be much higher. So right now it's a speculative asset.
Yeah. And sometimes people don't even know that, oh, there's a limited supply. Sometimes people buy it just because they heard from somebody else that that's the thing, the hype, and they just want to be part of it.
The ignorance of people that dabble in it is shocking. I still hear people say, like, I wish I could afford a Bitcoin, but they're just too expensive now. They don't even understand that you can buy a partial Bitcoin. You know, they don't even understand. They think, oh, it's $70,000. That's too much for me. They don't know you can buy $100 worth. They don't even understand that.
Yeah, you have to explain with meat. A pound of beef is this, but you're not going to buy a pound. You can buy less. Like.
Yeah, but the point is you have to explain that, and then they might get it, but then they're going to wonder why. And you can say, well, it's really not a Bitcoin, it's Satoshis, and there's 100 million per Bitcoin. That's the real unit. So we should probably call it Satoshi coin if we want to be clear. It's like the price of Bitcoin right now is only like 1/17 millionth of a cent or something. I don't know what it is. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, like, if you finish reading this book, I'm curious to see what you think of it. I hope you post something on Twitter, and maybe a discussion can carry on from there.
I'm trying to give it a close and fair read, and I appreciate Roger for writing it. And I guess Steve Patterson, his co-author, helped him write it. And I will say they've done a good job. I'm not an insider, so I don't know how much
You were on Steve Patterson's show a while ago talking about argumentation ethics, right? I think you
I
did his
believe so.
show.
Yeah, several years ago we did. That's before he started denying infinity and doing all these other things and getting into
Yeah, I didn't follow that. So
Yeah,
sorry.
he thinks that in, there's no such thing as infinity.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a theory, but he's apparently a good writer and he's smart, and so is Roger. No, I'm curious to get to the end of it. I'll let you know what I think. But didn't you have a business that you wanted to mention here or?
Oh yeah, sure. Like for example, I'm big on privacy stuff. You probably know Naomi Brockwell. She's
Yeah.
big on privacy as well. And like I like this VPN provider, Aria VPN, ariavpn.net. Go check it out. They have like a zero knowledge architecture, so they don't get your information. They don't log your activity. And they only accept crypto like Bitcoin Cash, Monero, and Bitcoin. So check them out, arevpn.net.
How
Thanks
do you
very
spell
much.
that? REI?
Aria, it's Aria is ARIA.net.
ARIA dot.
ARIA.net. Yeah, Aria. Yeah.
Okay, VPN. Okay, very good. All right, Bruno, I enjoyed it, and let's stay in touch, and we'll chat later.
Sure. Thank you very much, man. Right. Pleasure.